You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Okay, let's first generate our motivation. And come back to the wish to be of great benefit to sentient beings. And knowing that to do that, we have to improve the state of our own mind. To do this, we have to get ourselves together, learn how to identify afflictive emotions and how to overcome them, and how to identify constructive ones and enhance them. And so for this reason, we're going to listen to Nagarjuna's precious garland and pay attention well so we can remember the teachings and put them into practice. Okay, so last time we were talking about the horses and elephants, remember, at the magical show, and how they, you know, the magician, by casting a spell and putting this salve on them, could make sticks and pebbles look like real horses and elephants, so much so that the audience would get excited seeing them prance around, or afraid if they started running towards them. Whereas the magician knew, he'd still see the horses and elephants, but he wouldn't be taken in. He knew it was only, there weren't real horses and elephants, there were only sticks and pebbles. And the latecomers would look around and see these sticks and pebbles and all these people, like, oh, wow, look at that horse, and oh, the elephant's turd, and say, what's going on with these people? Are they crazy? You know, there's nothing here. So this, the analogy was made, you know, that the people who were seeing the horses and elephants, you know, they are like us, people who have the appearance of true existence and grasp of true existence, because our consciousnesses are all affected by ignorance, so we don't see things as they are. We see them in a hallucinated way, and then we believe the hallucination to be true. Okay? The magician is like the people who have a realization of emptiness, and then, and the break time when they arise after their meditation, they know that what's the true existence appearing to them is not, is a false appearance, but they still have that appearance, but they don't grasp at it. And then the people, the Aryas in meditative equipoise on emptiness, perceive only emptiness. So they're like the latecomers to the magical show. Okay, so the conclusion from that whole discussion, yeah, is that things do not exist from their own side. Yeah, and they appear falsely to our sense, our sense consciousnesses, and our mental consciousness then grasps these appearances as true, due to ignorance. In fact, phenomena exist as like illusions. Okay? They're not illusions, they're like illusions, in that just as an illusion appears falsely, you know, so too do things appear to our senses falsely. They appear truly existent, whereas they are not. And so the conclusion, you know, from that discussion was that. And then how do they exist? They exist by being merely designated, by being merely fabricated by conception. Okay? Then, verse 115. For this reason, and no other, the Buddha said that the world was indeterminate with regard to four aspects, having or not having an end, both or neither. Okay? So we're coming back to this whole thing of why the Buddha didn't answer these people's questions when they asked, you know, is there an end to the world? Is there not an end to the world? Is there an end to the self? Is there not an end to the self? Okay, both or neither. Okay, so here are the four alternatives: that the world has a truly existent end, it doesn't have an end, it has an end, it doesn't have an end, or it neither has an end, or it doesn't have an end. Okay, the neither sounds like it would almost be good. Yeah, yeah, it does. It neither has a truly existent end, and or doesn't have a truly existent end. Yeah, that's correct. Except that's not what neither means here. Neither means some other truly existent alternative. Okay, so of these four different extremes, you know, in this tetralemma, there were different schools, philosophical schools or religious schools at the time of the Buddha that asserted one or the other of these. Okay, so the Chakravakas, sorry, also called the Lokayatas, or hedonists in English, they say that the world has an end. Okay, so they say that there's a truly existent person in this life, and at the time of death, that truly existent person completely ceases to exist, like the flame of a candle that's gone out because all the wax is used up. So there's no continuity of the person into the next life. And the reason they say this is because they can't see past or future lives, therefore they don't exist. Okay? So there's people nowadays who believe this. Yeah? Yeah, we would call them materialists, but the same argument, you know, we don't see past and future lives, so they can't exist. And, you know, there's a truly existent person now, and after death, there's nothing. Yeah, so many people think like that now. You know, the problem with that is that they're grasping at true existence, and they can't understand that it's possible to posit a person who is not truly existent, but exists by, you know, mere designation, and that can still function like that. They also, you know, also there's a tinge of arrogance in that view. Like, if I don't perceive it, it doesn't exist. But we all know that, like, dogs and cats and birds can see and hear things that we can't. So that argument that, you know, we don't know it with our senses, so it doesn't exist, that we already know that that is inaccurate. Okay? Then the Samkhyas, they're... English name is enumerators. So they propound the view that the person does not have an end. Okay? So the hedonist, the person has an end. The Samkhyas, the person doesn't have an end because the person is permanent. Okay? So there's a permanent person that goes from one life to the next life endlessly. And so this permanent person creates the karma and experiences the results in a future life. Okay, so it's a truly existent, permanent person. And that's what they assert, because otherwise there's no way for them to posit a link between karma and its effects. They believe in karma and effects, but things existing by mere designation, without having some essence from their own side, they think that's just nonsense. It's like saying things are illusions, you know, and they don't really exist. So that's the Samkhyas. Then the Jains, they're also called the Nigranthans. So they say both the person both has an end and doesn't have an end. And the way they explain it is that the person is life, and life is the same size as the body. Okay? So life is some kind of force. It's the same size as the body. Its nature is permanent, but its states change. So part of it is impermanent. So it's kind of like saying that, you know, there's a permanent soul that doesn't change between lives, but something does change because you do have different people between life, you know, from one life to the next. So the soul is both permanent and impermanent, but it's still truly existent. Just, that's also kind of like saying I'm the same person as I was yesterday, except a few things about me have changed. But basically, you know, have the same name, I'm the same person, I'm permanent. Okay, so they say both. Yeah. Then there's a Buddhist sect called the Vatsiputriyas, who state that the person neither has an end nor doesn't have an end. And so they say that the person is such that we can't specify any specific existential state in terms of having an end or not having an end. So the person is some kind of self-sufficient substance, but its properties can't be explicitly determined. So they say it's neither has an end nor doesn't have an end. Okay, so all these philosophies are based on the notion that there's a person that exists from its own side, you know, with its own essence. And the propounders of all these different schools say that there must be a truly existent person. Otherwise, how do we connect the person who creates the karma with the person who creates, who experiences the result? And this has been the question, you know, from the Buddhist time, that actually all the Buddhist traditions are faced with, and they all come up with a different response about what it is that connects, yeah, the karma. Okay, but these people, you know, in these sects, they really stubbornly hold on to their wrong views. And so even the Buddha would try to explain to them that, you know, it's not that there's an end or no end or both or neither. They wouldn't understand. Yeah. And they would still keep grasping at a truly existent person. And so for that reason, the Buddha just, he didn't respond to their questions. Because whatever he said, they would take it in the wrong way and use it to further their wrong view. Okay. Then verse 116 and 117. These verses are very good, these two. Okay. The impurity of the body is obvious. It is an object of direct perception. Although one can see it constantly, it does not remain in one's mind. If that is the case, then how could this extremely subtle, profound, and unlocated holy dharma, which is not directly perceivable by our senses, easily enter into one's mind? Okay, so we look at, let's do one verse 117 first. Okay, so the dharma of the highest good, the teaching on emptiness, is difficult for people who are not suitable vessels, because to understand emptiness, they must understand the non-existence of the conceived object of true grasping. Okay? So when true grasping holds an object, its conceived object, it's erroneous with respect to its conceived object because it conceives of an inherently existent person. And that person does not exist. So they, you know, to understand the Dharma of the highest good, you have to understand that that conceived object, what the true grasping is holding, yeah, does not exist at all. Okay? And it's very difficult to for them to understand that. First of all, because there's just the regular ignorance that clouds our mind. But second of all, they've learned all these false philosophies, and as we talked about in the previous weeks, just learning a false philosophy can be put so many impediments, you know, in our path, even if it's something that we just learned this lifetime and it's not innate. Okay, so so to go into verse 117 a little bit more, sentient beings, you know, we can't see things such as subtle impermanence, the momentary change of objects, or the selflessness with our sense faculties. The only way we can see those very obscure objects is through, they're not very obscure, they're slightly obscure. So the only way we can see those slightly obscure objects is by using a reasoning, you know, a syllogism. Like, sound is impermanent because it's a product of causes, okay? Or the person does not truly exist because it's a dependent arising, okay? So you have to understand those signs. And by the way, you know, it may seem rather puzzling to us because when we talk to our Theravada friends, they may not, you know, we're talking about syllogisms and the three criteria for correct syllogism. And not all of them talk like that. They talk about like the four establishments of mindfulness, you know, on how to read, how to understand subtle impermanence or subtle selflessness. And then we get confused about, well, do you sit, you know, how do you realize it? Is it like the Madhyamikas and you sit and just contemplate a syllogism, or do you meditate on the four establishments of mindfulness? I mean, they seem like two very different methods, and what do you, you know, how do you bring them together? Actually, when you start meditating on the four establishments of mindfulness, what you come to understand through that can be expressed in a syllogism. Okay? Because if you're meditating on the four mindfulnesses, let's say on impermanence, then, you know, you're trying to cultivate very deep concentration that's, let's say, focusing on the body and watching how the body changes moment to moment to moment. Yeah? As you watch that momentary change of the body, the understanding comes into your mind that the body is impermanent because it's produced by causes. That's the understanding that comes to your mind through watching that momentary change. Okay? So if you start out with the meditation, you're going to get to the syllogism, even though you may not say, oh, I have a syllogism, and here are the three criteria that make it valid. You know, you may not say that. If you're somebody who starts out with the syllogism, you've got to go beyond just intellectually reciting the syllogism to yourself and saying, oh, yes, the three criteria hold. Yes, sound is a product of causes, so the reason pertains to the subject. And if it's a product of causes, yes, it's got to be impermanent, so there's pervasion. And if it's not impermanent, so if it's permanent, then it's not a product of causes, so there's the counter-pervasion. Oh, yeah, you know, that doesn't bring you any realization. That's just intellectual blah blah. But if you really meditate deeply on what you're saying, then you have to make an example for yourself in your own meditation. So you take something such as your body, because it's a very handy object to examine, or your feelings, it could be any of the five aggregates, and you start looking at that and saying, okay, this thing is produced by causes. What's happening with it? Does it stay the same every moment? And eventually what you're going to get to in your meditation is the same experiential feeling. Okay? So these two ways are not contradictory.
Is the four establishment of mindfulness really from the Theravada? Because I heard that from I thought it's also in the Tibetan tradition.
Yes, it is in the Tibetan tradition. And that's why, you know, usually they'll teach you the syllogisms, but the four establishments of mindfulness are definitely in the Tibetan tradition. So, if, you know, you're meditating on the syllogism, you're also going to be meditating on the four establishments. Yeah. Okay, so it comes back to that. Okay? So sentient beings, you know, can't see these kind of things with their senses. We need to rely on a syllogism, or a syllogistic understanding, I should say. And so first there we would realize, you know, subtle impermanence or subtle selflessness inferentially, and then through meditating more and more, realizing these things directly. Okay? But some people, when you try and, like, explain a syllogism to them, their thing is, like, syllogism, three criteria, the reason, pertaining to the subject, and there's a thesis and a predicate, and there's pervasion and counter-pervasion, and, like, can't you talk regular English? It's like, you know, and their way their minds are, they're just intimidated by all that kind of talk. Okay, so they don't even want to examine things like that. It's like, oh, that's too, you know, difficult, too complicated. Okay, so here we have the difficulty of understanding subtle impermanence and subtle selflessness. Even if you do understand the reasoning, you know, meditating on them over time, gaining the inference, then gaining the direct perceiver. Okay, so that takes some time. It's not easy. Okay, but it's doable. Then, if we go to verse 116, the impurity of the body is obvious. It's an object of direct perception. Okay? So that's true, isn't it? Uh-huh. Especially, I mean, if you meditate on the mindfulness of the body. Yeah. Even if you don't meditate on the mindfulness of the body, you have a body. You look at what comes out of your body. Every orifice in our body produces something that's yucky. Yeah? If you see somebody in an accident on the highway and their body is injured and the blood's coming out or the guts are coming out, everybody goes, ugh! You know, it's like the foulness of the body we can see very directly with our senses. It's not difficult at all. Okay? Is it? It's very easy. Okay. Now, do people in our culture think that the body is foul? No. How about most of the time for us? Do we think our body's foul? No. We think our body's kind of nice. Yeah. Okay, we wash it, but that's because other stuff makes this pure body a little bit dirty. Yeah. It's not that this body is dirty by nature. Other stuff kind of contaminates it, so we have to wash that off. Yeah. So even though the foulness of the body is perceivable by our senses, and even though we know that, we can't hold it in our mind for very long, can we? Yeah. You may say, oh, my body's foul, And then there's pumpkin pie. And do you think, oh, that pumpkin pie is foul? Look what it's going to look like when it goes in my body? No, you don't think that. You don't look at the pumpkin pie and say that's, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow's poo. You say, that's delicious pumpkin pie, and I have this perfectly clean body that is going to eat it. Imagining we eat the pumpkin pie, and that it looks like pure pumpkin pie the whole time. It goes down. But you know, if you eat the pumpkin pie and then you throw up right away, it looks different. Do you think that it's pure then? Yeah, would you eat it again? Eat your own vomit? No way.
Kids are doing this.
Okay. So, we can't even hold it in our own minds about, the body being foul. So given how difficult that is to hold in our mind, even though it's perceivable by our senses, think of how much more difficult it is to understand emptiness, which we have to perceive through an inference first, because it's not perceivable by our senses. Yeah. Let alone hold it in our mind for any period of time. So, the conclusion is comparing the ease of realizing the body is unclean and the difficulty of realizing emptiness and being aware that the foulness of the body doesn't stay in our minds. It's no wonder that it's difficult to realize emptiness. Yeah. But it's even more surprising that people think they can realize emptiness without first understanding that the body's foul. And I've been in, I remember one time with Geshe Zopa, and he was talking about this, and one man who was a long-time Dharma student, I knew him from Dharamsala from ages ago, and he was saying, but the body's not foul. Yeah, the body's not impure. The body is this wonderful organism that operates in such mystical, secret ways that keep us alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not foul and unclean. And, emptiness, I want to realize emptiness. Yeah? And so he was completely resistant to the idea of the body being foul. So let alone understand that and compare it with the difficulty of realizing emptiness. He wanted to skip that and go directly to emptiness. Yeah. So those two verses kind of make us a little bit humble, if we think like, oh yeah, emptiness, no problem, it's a cinch. Okay. Yes.
It seems like we hold both those views. We can see the body as foul sometimes.
Yeah.
And yet we have a deep-rooted wrong view that contradicts that.
Right.
And it's just...
Yeah, it's the difference between knowing something in our head and knowing something because it's integrated with our mind.
Have we already integrated that wrong view?
We're very attached to that wrong view. Very attached. Our whole society thrives on that wrong view. What would happen if in school they taught children that your body's filthy? Nobody would go out shopping. Yeah, because why are you going to buy beautiful clothes to put on a filthy body? It's bad for the economy. So, and how could you make Hollywood films and sell them if people believe that the body were filthy. Yeah, you could no longer make Hollywood films. Again, bad for the economy. So we're quite happy to live with our wrong views. It's kind of scary when you think about it.
Power.
Right, the entire fitness industry.
All the beauty salons.
All the beauty salons. Yeah.
Morticians.
All the on-time dating things. All the morticians. I mean, boy, the whole society would fall apart if everybody meditated on the foulness of the body. Yeah. So when people ask me questions, sometimes people say, what happens if everybody becomes a monk or a nun? You know? And I usually say, well, that's a problem to think about it, but let's think about it when it happens. I don't think we're threatened by that problem anytime soon. Yeah? So that's one problem maybe that, you know, we don't need to stress about. Yeah? I mean, do all the business executives go, oh no, these Buddhists, they're going to tell everybody the body's foul. What's going to happen to our business? Yeah, we've got to stop these Buddhists. No, the executives don't think. We're no threat to the executives. You know, wrong views are doing quite well. They're very prosperous. You know, they all, on the stock market, wrong views constantly rise. They never, you know, you never have an unstable stock market on wrong views. Yeah, you bought your stock in wrong views, you'd be a millionaire.
It's a new analogy, Spinner.
Okay, verse 118. Hence, having attained awakening, the sage realized that since this Dharma was so profound, people would not understand it. And so he refrained from teaching the Dharma. Okay? So just after the Buddha attained full awakening under the Bodhi tree, yeah, he said, I have found the nectar of the deathless, a Dharma that is profound, peaceful, free of elaborations, clear light, and uncreated. Since whomever I teach this to will not be able to understand it, for a while I will stay in the forest and be silent. Okay? So for 49 days, he didn't manifest turning the Dharma wheel of the four truths of the Aryas because he figured nobody would understand it. Okay, and the Dharma that he was saying that was so profound was the Dharma of emptiness. So it's profound because it's not obvious and must initially be realized by using reasoning. So it's a slightly obscure phenomena. It's peaceful because by meditating on it, the afflictions in our mind stream are pacified. It's free of elaborations because it is free of the appearance of true existence. And it is clear light, the luminous nature of the mind, because it is not stained by true existence. Actually, you can't say emptiness is the luminous nature of the mind. That's not correct, but it's getting that point, okay, that the luminous nature of the mind is not stained by true existence. So it's called clear light. But clear light is, it needs to be said, it is clear light because the luminous nature of the mind is not stained by true existence. Yeah. Then 119 and 120 come together. If this Dharma is misunderstood, it will ruin the unwise. for they will sink deeply into the filth of nihilistic views. And from misunderstanding this Dharma, fools who presume themselves pundits, ruined by their denial of it, plummet straight down to avici hell. Okay, so these two verses talk about the disadvantages of misunderstanding or misconceiving profound emptiness. Okay, so here, somebody comes along, you know, our friend Joe Blow, he's, you know, always around. So he says, if the profound is easy, there's not much purpose in the Buddha explaining it, because it's easy. And if it's difficult to understand, he should explain it repeatedly with many reasons. Okay? So this again raises the question of who should be taught emptiness. Yeah? And the disadvantages that ensue from teaching it to inappropriate vessels. So it should not be explained to people lacking in wisdom, so people who aren't intelligent in the way of the Dharma, and who would not understand it. So people who are holding very strong wrong views, thinking that their views are correct. Yeah, it doesn't work to teach them the Dharma because they will only misunderstand it and think that the Buddha's teaching nihilism, that nothing exists. Similarly, another group of people that shouldn't be taught emptiness are people who are arrogant, who have an inflated sense of their own intelligence, because they will also misunderstand it and then teach it to other people, which is really dangerous. Okay? So for the first group of people who are unwise in the way of the Dharma, or, you know, who cling to wrong views very strongly, if you teach them emptiness, they will misunderstand it, and they will think that nothing exists, and that three jewels don't exist, yeah, four truths don't exist, karma and its effects don't exist. So if there's no karma and its effects, there's no ethical conduct, then you can do whatever you want, just don't get caught. Yeah? And so it, you know, by that having that wrong view, then acting on it, then they create all sorts of horrible karma that, you know, that ruins them, that sends them to the lower realms. Yeah? And you can see this, you know, people who have that kind of view. Yeah? I held that view for a while, you know, in my younger years, like, you know, there's nothing after death. When you die, there's like zero. So, yeah, do whatever. Yeah, just don't get caught. And don't look bad. You know, there's attachment to reputation. Don't hold me back. Yeah. And fear of getting in trouble. But that was it, you know. Okay, so then the second type of person, you know, is somebody who presumes themselves to be very intelligent. They think they're a pundit, and they think they're highly educated and intelligent, but they also misunderstand the meaning of Dharma. Maybe they think the meaning of emptiness, maybe they think that it means total non-existence, or sometimes they think that emptiness of inherent existence isn't the actual nature of the mind. Or they might think that emptiness is truly existent. Yeah, something like that. And so again, ruined by their denial of the correct view of emptiness, they wind up in a hellish rebirth. Okay, so these people, you know, out of compassion for them, the Buddha didn't teach emptiness. He would teach them other things, yeah? And so, you know, he might teach them, and depending on the people, who they were, you know, maybe he would teach them something about generosity so that they would create some good karma. Or maybe if they were people who suffered from a lot of anger and they wanted to help with their anger, then he would teach them the methods to practice fortitude. So he would teach them something, you know, if they could understand that. Of course, if they were too immersed in their wrong views, they would say generosity is useless and anger is good, and so then you're, you know, there's really not much to say after that. You know? So this verse is really written kind of as a warning for people who might be going down the path to nihilism. So, you know, it's natural when you're learning about emptiness that sometimes you might go, well, what is all this stuff of non-inherent existence? What's it all about, you know? And kind of really puzzle about it. But if you find that you're beginning to think, oh, you know, I'm doing the four-point analysis and I can't find anything, so everything is totally non-existent. This everything is a hallucination, you know. Not like a hallucination, but is a hallucination. Yeah. So if you find yourself going down, beginning to think like that, yeah, and falling into the extreme of nihilism, then it's better to back off your study of emptiness and instead do some other practices that fit more with you, you know? So if you feel, you know, like if meditating on loving kindness and compassion soothes your mind, then meditate on that, yeah? Or some devotional practices to the Buddha, or, you know, whatever kind of meditation you find, you know, suits your mind, do that. And don't push yourself to understand emptiness if you find that your mind's kind of starting to spin into this, well, nothing matters, everything's useless, when I die there's nothing, and, you know, if you're going towards that end, don't go down that road. Okay? So then, okay, Joe Blow comes along again and he says, it is said that except for the Arya's wisdom of meditative equipoise, directly realizing emptiness, all consciousnesses of sentient beings are mistaken in that they have the appearance of true existence. That's correct. But then he says, in that case, are all the reliable consciousnesses of sentient beings mistaken? You know? And he's thinking, well, yeah, you know, if only the Arya's meditative equipoise on emptiness sees things as they actually are, is empty of true existence, and every other consciousness is mistaken, then reliable consciousnesses that can tell us what exists and what don't exist, there aren't such things because they're also mistaken because they have the appearance of true existence. Okay? So this is what that person's thinking. So according to the Prasangika view, okay, the lower schools don't agree, but the Prasangika view, they say that a reliable consciousness can be mistaken with respect to its appearing object. Okay? So a reliable consciousness is not mistaken with respect to its apprehended object or its conceived object, if it's a conceptual consciousness. But a reliable cognizer can be mistaken with respect to its appearing object. So, for example, when we look, you know, at the color red here, the red appears to us truly existent. So the red is the appearing object. It's mistaken because it appears to us to be truly existent. But if it's our visual consciousness does not apprehend or grasp true existence, only our mental consciousness does. So the apprehended object of the visual consciousness is just the color red. And it apprehends in terms of knowing red from green and purple. It's a reliable consciousness. In terms of the appearing object, you know, the red appearing truly existent, it's mistaken. Okay. But it's not erroneous because it can see that it's red. It doesn't think of it as, you know, blue or chartreuse or something like that. Okay? Now, so it's that's for the sense consciousnesses. Now, for our mental consciousness, when we are thinking about something, automatically the mental consciousness is mistaken with respect to the appearing object because it's mediated by a conceptual appearance. So that holds true across the board for all the schools, okay? Because a conceptual appearance, you know, it's not the actual object, okay? So it's mistaken with respect to that. From the Prasangika viewpoint, the objects of mental consciousness are also mistaken because they appear truly existent to the mental consciousness. So, you know, the appearing object is, you know, it's mistaken with respect to the appearing object, okay? Now, if you're thinking about the red, and you're just thinking about red, then your mind is mistaken with respect, you know, to the appearing object of your thought about red because it's a conceptual appearance and because it's appearing truly existent. But it's not mistaken regarding the apprehended object, which is just the red color. That's okay, even you're thinking about red. Like, you look at the red, then you think about it later, like, what shade of red was that? You know? And you've got it, you're in your mind, and that's not erroneous. Now, if you start to grasp the red as truly existent, then that mental consciousness becomes erroneous with respect to its apprehended object. Okay? Or, yeah, so that's good. Good enough. Okay? So, think Dharma things like bodhicitta, love, compassion, the inferential realization of emptiness. These are all things that are known by conceptual consciousnesses. So they're mistaken in the sense that their appearing objects appear truly existent. But they're reliable consciousnesses because they're knowing their objects correctly. When you meditate on love or compassion or bodhicitta, inferential understanding of emptiness, it's the right thing. So those minds are not erroneous, and they do apprehend their apprehended object correctly. So don't think, don't get things mixed up and think, all the consciousnesses except Anarya's meditative equipoise and emptiness, all the other ones are mistaken. So there's no use to meditate on bodhicitta and love and compassion because those are mistaken consciousnesses. Don't think like that because that's a big mistake. Okay? You're getting what I'm saying? So Jay Rinpoche really, he spent a lot of time on this, saying that even though things appear falsely to the mind in terms of the appearing objects, we can still have reliable cognizers that enable us to function in the world, even though we may be, the consciousness may be mistaken with respect to the appearing object. Because otherwise you're stuck with saying everything is totally erroneous and there's no reliable consciousnesses. And then, that means you can't even, identify this as a table, which is ridiculous, because we can. But the truly existent table that's appearing to us the table, that table does not exist as it appears to us. Okay. So then, verse 123, therefore, do not deny this Dharma. Are we?
No, we're on
21, 22. Yeah, 21, 22. Okay. So through eating poor food, one will come to ruin. But by eating the right food, one maintains vigor, health, strength, and pleasure. And 22, likewise, through poor understanding, one will come to ruin. But from the right understanding, one attains happiness and unexcelled awakening. Okay. So, just as we're ruined if we eat spoiled food, yeah, misunderstanding emptiness also brings dire results. Yeah, but eating nourishing food in proper amounts, then we experience long life, good health, you know, freedom from illness, strength, and physical and mental well-being. Okay, so similarly, yeah, so it's like, if you misunderstand emptiness, it's like eating bad food. If you understand it correctly, it makes you well. Yeah. So then they give the example here too about a person who is intelligent and conscientious, who is knowledgeable about snakes and how to cast spells on them, can apply a substance and cast a spell on a snake, and then be able to handle it. And people in India can do this nowadays. Yeah? My friends at Root Institute have said that there's somebody in Bodh Gaya who can take these big snakes and charm them and just put them around, you know, wear them like a necklace. Okay? So that's possible. Yeah? And they're able to handle the snakes. But a person who doesn't know how to apply the substance correctly or cast the spell correctly and does everything the wrong way, they're going to be in big trouble if they try and pick up the snake. Okay, so the whole idea is you have to know about these things properly and practice them properly. Okay? But, so similarly with emptiness, if we do that, then we'll go from happiness to happiness. We'll have a series of good rebirths with all the conditions to learn and practice the Dharma, and eventually we'll attain full awakening. And then 123, therefore, do not deny this Dharma and abandon nihilistic views. In order to obtain all aims, strive for perfect understanding. So this is a verse summarizing the whole point here of the, you know, this section. You know, the view of existence is absolutism. The view of non-existence is nihilism. Okay. So abandoning these two views, try and understand the correct view of emptiness, the middle way view, and through that, accomplish the welfare of yourself and other living beings. Okay, and in this way, make your life meaningful. So that's Nagarjuna's closing advice to us for this section. So remember chapter 2, it's the interwoven one, because he's starting out with the highest good, then he's going to higher rebirth, then he's going to go back to the highest good. So starting with verse 124, he's going to go back to the causes and effects of higher rebirth. Okay. So do you want to do a little bit of that? Shall we start that? Okay. So, since we may not be able to attain the highest good in this life, then it's important to create the causes for an upper rebirth. Okay, so that we'll have an uninterrupted series of good rebirths so we can practice the Dharma and realize emptiness and so on. Okay, and so because this is a text that Nagarjuna is teaching to a king, Yeah? So he's going to now explain things that the king should and shouldn't do in order to create the karma for a good rebirth. Yeah. So one of the things that the king should abandon is following bad political treatises. He should enact Dharma policies instead. So apparently at that time, there were these people who wrote political treatises with all sorts of horrible views in them. Now people don't have to write them, they just go on TV and talk them. Yeah, all sorts of horrible wrong views. And if you're a leader and you adopt those kind of views and put those policies into effect in your land, personally you're going to create a lot of negative karma. Your subjects are going to be unhappy. There's going to be unrest in the land. And nobody's going to benefit from the whole thing. Okay? So he's going to he's going to advise the king not to pay attention to these political treatises. Then he's also going to talk about the four ways of attracting others. Okay, in the Lamrim, that comes right after the six perfections. And then he's going to talk about four good practices to adopt: truth, generosity, peace, and wisdom. He'll talk about choosing companions wisely and remembering impermanence and death, and then forsaking the causes of rebirth in the lower realms. So that's what's coming up in this next section. Okay? So, verse 124. When this Dharma is not understood, eye grasping continues. Due to that, one engages in constructive and destructive karma, and from that comes fortunate and unfortunate rebirths. Okay, so when, we still can't penetrate the eye grasping, we can't penetrate the view of the personal identity, and they continue to function and arise, all throughout the day, then due to that, attachment will arise very easily, anger will arise easily, resentment, all these kinds of things, jealousy, all of them will arise very easily because our inappropriate attention is going to exaggerate the good or bad qualities of objects, and then the afflictions are going to rise and then we create destructive karma. Okay? So when these disturbing emotions aren't manifest in our minds, we can create constructive karma. But that too, when we're ordinary beings, is done under the influence of ignorance. Okay? So it still originates with eye grasping, the first of the 12 links, grasping at true existence. And then it might, that grasping, the view of the personal identity, is not negative. It's a neutral mental factor. It's not virtuous or non-virtuous. It's neutral because it can arise and, influenced by it, you can have virtuous mental factors arise in your mind that will produce good karma. But because it's also rooted in ignorance, the good karma leads to upper rebirths. It doesn't lead to liberation and awakening. Okay? So when we understand this, then we can understand when they say that wandering in cyclic existence is caused by not realizing emptiness. Yeah? Okay? So if we don't realize emptiness and, eliminate our afflictions, let alone not be able to help others, we won't be able to help ourselves. Okay? And so, we really have to put effort into understanding emptiness. But if we can't, since we may not realize it this life, we really have to cover our bases and make sure that we create a lot of virtuous karma so that we can have an upper rebirth and continue to practice the Dharma. Okay, so 125. Therefore, as long as you have not understood this Dharma that destroys the eye grasping, devote yourself to the Dharma of generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. Okay, so this is talking about exert yourself to have higher rebirths until you realize selflessness. Okay, so therefore, you know, until we realize emptiness, we have to create virtue. So these three practices are very good ones. They include the 16 causes of the higher rebirth that Nagarjuna spoke about before. Can we remember the 16 causes? Okay, what are the 13 to abandon?
The
10 non-virtues. Okay, you got those 10. Then?
Intoxicants.
Harming others. And wrong livelihood. Yeah. So intoxicants, wrong livelihood, and harming others. And then there's three to practice.
Generosity.
Love. And honoring those worthy of honor. Okay. Honoring those worthy of honor. Okay, so these those 16 can be subsumed in generosity, ethical conduct, and fortitude. Interesting that as Westerners, what's the one we forgot?
Honoring
those worthy of honor. It says something about us, doesn't it? Yeah? Okay, so then 126 and 127 come together. King, if you undertake deeds that begin with Dharma, have Dharma in the middle and Dharma at the end, you will not be harmed in this world or the next. Through Dharma, you attain fame and pleasure. You will have no fear now or at death. And in the next world, you will have great joy. So always devote yourself to the Dharma. Yeah, beautiful verses, aren't they? Very practical. Okay, so the advantages of training in the cause. Yeah, so the first verse is saying before acting with our body, speech, and mind, we need to check our motivation. Okay, and make sure that you know, before we undertake any kind of action or engage in something, that we have a good motivation. Yeah? So, undertake deeds that begin with Dharma. So, that begin with either the conscious determination not to cause harm and to refrain from the 10 non-virtues, or that begin with an attitude of kindness or love or compassion, yeah, a wish, an attitude of generosity, okay, some kind of good motivation, yeah. So to make sure before we act that there's a good motivation behind it. Then in the middle, to make sure that we maintain that good motivation. Because sometimes we start out with a good motivation. You know, like in our morning meetings, we recite our verse afterwards. And sometimes we may actually pay attention to what we're saying and have a good motivation. And then immediately after the meeting, when we have to discuss with somebody about how to organize some task, these people, you know, they're so impractical, they're so stubborn, they don't agree with my view. Yeah. They don't listen. What was that phrase we learned?
See how they are.
See how they are. Yeah. See how they are, like, oh, these people. So we start out with a good motivation, then in the middle, gone. So we have to make sure we keep the good motivation in the middle while we're doing the action. And then also at the end, make sure the motivation is good and that we dedicate the merit. Yeah, so this requires paying a lot of attention to our mind, doesn't it? Because so quickly we get angry and defensive. Yeah, we get competitive. We get egotistical in one way or another, don't we? Okay. So Nagarjuna is saying, be careful, you know, and if you do this, then you will receive many benefits from it, okay? So he gives five benefits here. So first, by acting with integrity and with kindness, you will have a good reputation. So that's a worldly benefit. But, you know, considering that most of us are attached to our reputations, you know, it's good. But also, you know, if you really want to benefit sentient beings, you have to have a good reputation. Yeah, because if you're behaving in an obnoxious way and people think that you're an obnoxious person, you may speak the Buddha's teachings, but nobody's going to listen. Yeah. Okay, so one is that we have a good reputation, which we will hopefully use to benefit sentient beings, not for egotistical reasons, to take advantage of others and exploit them. Second, due to not acting in destructive ways, we won't be overwhelmed with remorse and regret, and we'll have a happy mind. So our mind will be peaceful. We won't be full of like, oh my God, why did I say that? Why did I do this? I just, you know, trashed the person that I really care about. I just exploded at my child. I just, you know, exploded at my boss. You know, so we won't have so much regret and inner turmoil. And then three, by practicing nonviolence in this life, you will be free of fear, and neither human beings nor spirits will have any reason to harm you. Yeah? So, you know, if we act like a kind person, people won't have a wish to harm us. At the end, at the time of death, we'll die peacefully, free of fear of an unfortunate rebirth, because we will have abandoned the causes for an unfortunate rebirth, created the causes for fortunate ones. So at the time of death, we'll die peacefully. And then also in this life and in future lives, our happiness will continue to expand. Yeah, you go from happiness to happiness by creating virtue. Yeah. So therefore, always maintain a virtuous attitude before, during, and at the conclusion of all of our actions. So this is part of the reason why when we wake up in the morning, we generate a good motivation. In the evening, we rejoice and dedicate the merit. Yeah. And if we practice like this, then we'll have results beginning in this life and continuing into future lives. Okay, so let's pause here.
Sure. About this view of the personal identity being a neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right there in the list of the six root afflictions,
mm-hmm.
number numero uno.
Yeah.
So
no, ignorance is.
But of that six, that wrong.
The view of the personal.
Your personal identity is the first.
It's the first of the afflicted views.
Afflicted views. So are all of those neutral?
Are all of the afflicted views neutral? I don't think so.
Okay. So
why? Well, the wrong
try
views.
To categorize them.
Yeah, the wrong views definitely are not neutral.
Yeah.
The wrong views about ethics and ceremonies and observance, that one's not neutral. Okay. The eternalism and nihilism. Doubt that, and rejoicing at those ones as correct views. I don't think so. Yeah.
So just that one.
Yeah. And ignorance itself is neutral.
Uh-huh.
But we can check up on that. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should say this is in the desire realm. In the upper realms, it's different. Sorry.
I guess I just have a funny, when we see all of these verses about people who aren't intelligent and that they're going to get into trouble trying, there's a misunderstanding, emptiness, or they don't have the ability. It's going to be kind of a strange question, but where do we stand?
Well, if you're listening to this text and it's making some sense to you, then you're not one of those people. You're not protected absolutely 100% from being one of them, because if somebody else came along and started teaching you, you know, about there's a creator God and da-da-da-da, this and this, and come join our group, and everybody's friendly to you and loves you, and you get a whole doctrine and all this, you know, we could easily change our views.
So it's not very, it's not stable at all. So being careful to...
Yeah, it's being careful.
Yeah, because I sometimes just get kind of like a little nervous about my own ignorance and you know, not tracking things sometimes very correctly.
No, but if you have respect for your precepts and respect for ethical conduct, then you're not, you know, falling here.
Okay.
It seems like the comment on verse 120 about if you're finding yourself leaning towards wrong views, to focus on other topics really addresses that. Because those other topics not only keep us from thinking about something that's not doing us good, but they also help to steer a mind where we can understand that.
A little break.
Right.
Which is where a lot of us are at.
Also, because to understand emptiness, we have to do a lot of purification and creation of merit. We can't just sit there and force, I'm going to study emptiness, I'm going to study emptiness, I'm going to study emptiness. You know? No, we have to purify and create merit too, and learn to relax our mind a bit. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, Nagarjuna is teaching this king. Who, you know? So I think we must have some potential if he's teaching this king, you know, because sometimes people who are super wealthy and super high status have a very difficult time understanding the Dharma, you know, because it challenges everything they spent their whole life working for. Yeah, so this king was receptive, and Nagarjuna is teaching him, and the king's clearly making progress. He's not an idiot, otherwise Nagarjuna wouldn't have jumped into explaining emptiness in the first chapter. Yeah. So
when we have the wrong views about how we perceive our bodies, the whole thing about the four distortions, we're still not going, I mean, we're just stuck in a fundamental place, but we're not heading off into some tracking. Because that's how four distortions play themselves out all the time.
Oh yeah, the four distortions are running rampant in our mind. But at least maybe intellectually you don't adhere when somebody reminds you about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not like the person I was talking about who said to Geshe Zopa that the body's beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, like we go through our life, my body's gorgeous and da-da-da-da, but, you know, if we spend 1 minute thinking, we all very easily acknowledge our bodies, you know.
Gross.
Okay. So, you know, in terms of the wrong views, you know, there's something we're holding on to on a very deep level, but at least intellectually we can understand that that view isn't correct.
So we're at least struggling with that view rather than perpetuating it.
Right. Yeah. We're trying to overcome it. Okay. Okay, shall we dedicate?
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Gurana Mandala Kandiryataya Me.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tents and gaps of generosity, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of
explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and non-violent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti and